The actor Robert Duvall died earlier this year at the age of 95, and I've always been a fan of his movies. And since his passing, I've resolved to watch every Robert Duvall movie between now and the end of the year. I got off to a good start, but I faltered a little bit, but I still hope to catch up. And my favorite Robert Duvall movie happens to be the only one for which he actually won an Oscar. He won the Oscar for Best Actor in the 1983 film Tender Mercies, which I think is a wonderful film, and it's based on a screenplay written by that wonderful Texas playwright, Horton Foote. And Robert Duvall plays a country western singer named Max Sledge, whose life has unraveled because of his addiction to alcohol. And he gets into a bar fight, he wakes up the next morning, and he goes to a widow who runs a gas station hotel along with her son, her husband having died in Vietnam. And Max Sledge proposes that he could try to earn his a room and board if he does all kinds of work for her around the place. And she says, okay, but you cannot drink. And so he agrees. And then some of the major plot points in the film kind of happen off camera. Like you don't see Mac and the widow fall in love, but you see them getting married. You don't see Mac coming to a place of faith, but then you see this scene in the Baptist church where both Mac and the widow's young son are baptized. And it's a Baptist type of baptism where full immersion into the water and then back up again. And when they're riding in the pickup truck on the way back, Mac and the young boy are talking to each other, and they're talking about how they've both been baptized, and the young boy says to Mac, do you feel any different yet? And Mac says, no, not yet. And the young boy says, neither do I. And I was baptized at the age of 10, and I have to admit that I had a similar feeling, like it was a great and wondrous thing, but I wasn't quite sure if I felt that different. And yet that seems to be such a contrast with what Paul says. Paul seems to talk in such absolute terms, like, do you not know that those of you who have been baptized into Christ have died to sin, and you've risen with Christ in newness of life? If only it were that cut and dry. But most of the time it's not. Now, I know that many people have different faith journeys, and for many people there is a decisive before and after in their life. And I want to honor that. But that's not true of everyone. It is not a one-size-fits-all. And as a church, we say that we welcome you wherever you are on your faith journey and whatever your faith journey might look like. And so how can those of us who may not have this decisive before and after moment, how can we relate to what Paul is saying here? And Beverly Roberts Gaventa, the New Testament scholar, has helped me to understand some of this. But she points out that when even Paul is talking like this, when Paul is talking like before and after, what he's really saying is that there are two separate powers. There is a power of sin and of death, the tragic element in human life. And there's also the power of grace. But this is not Star Wars, where the two forces are kind of equal in strength. Instead, grace predominates. Grace is always the greater force. Grace had the first word. We're all created good. And the words of the Confession of Faith that we'll say later, the good in us, in all humanity, is planted more deeply than all that is wrong. That's always the first word. Grace has the first word. At the same time, there is a power of sin. And we overcome that sin through grace. We cannot do it on our own. And one of the things that Beverly Roberts Govinda pointed out for me was that when Paul talks about sin, he doesn't talk about repentance. He doesn't wag the finger and say, you have to get your act together and stop sinning. I mean, it kind of sounds like he's saying that, but that's not the essence of what he's saying. For Paul, we're rescued from sin. And this fits so well with many people who have stories about addiction. The first step in many 12-step programs is to admit that I was powerless over my addiction and had to give my life over to a greater power. And it's the power of grace that helps take us out of that. Grace that is mediated through the help of others, through other people sharing their stories, listening to us. And the way Paul talks about sin also resonates with what we know about family dynamics in many cases, where generational patterns repeat themselves, even though we have all the best intentions of breaking those patterns. And there's a tragic element in which all of society gets caught up in sin. I've been doing a lot of work on Ancestry.com, trying to find a Union Army ancestor, and alas, no luck. They were all Confederates, every single one of them. And so how do I understand the fact that many of them were loving parents who did their best to live by a moral code, and yet along with the rest of people in their society, they had this huge blind spot about the evils of slavery? Something like this is what Paul means by the power of sin, that there is this tragic element that is there that we can't quite fully transcend on our own. And even in our own time, will future generations look back at us and wonder, how could they tolerate such huge inequalities in wealth? How could they tolerate such examples of cruelty and everything else? There is this tragic element in which we're caught up in these forces that are beyond our control. But the theme of the summer is hope. And I've just said a lot of things that don't sound all that hopeful. But at the end of the day, as we spend more time with Paul in Romans, we realize that grace is the more powerful force. That is the source of our hopefulness. That there is a rescue. That grace we experience through the help of each other, by sharing our stories honestly, listening to other people share their stories, as a church, doing our best to love each other and love the world around us. In all these ways, grace is shown. And I've long been an admirer of a Lutheran preacher named Nadia Boles Weber. She grew up in the same very conservative denomination that I grew up in, the Churches of Christ, which didn't even allow women to preach, but yet she emerged as a very gifted preacher. She became a Lutheran, but she didn't want to be a typical Lutheran pastor. She has a number of religious tattoos. She curses like a sailor. And she founded a church in downtown Denver, Colorado, which was intended to be for people who didn't normally feel comfortable in church. For people who were living on the street, people who were kicked out of their houses for being gay or trans, for people that you would not think likely to attend church, she wanted to be a church where everyone could find grace. And she did bring in many people who were living on the streets into her church. But she also brought wealthy yuppies from the suburbs who came in to like hear her preach and to experience this church. And she said that it tested her own ideas about inclusiveness. That when she talked about being an inclusive church, it really meant being inclusive to everyone. But the thing that I like best about her is the way that she writes about grace. And she's very honest about her own addiction story. She grew up Church of Christ, rebelled against it, dropped out of Pepperdine. Was very abusive with alcohol, nearly died several times. And what finally happened for her was not that she got scared, but she got scared that she wasn't getting scared. Like, oh my goodness, I could have died, I could have killed someone because of my addiction. How come I'm not scared? And being scared of not being scared was what began the process of transformation. And so on the Christmas day the day after Christmas Day in 1991, she stopped drinking, and she's been sober for the 34 and a half years since then. But when she writes about it, she doesn't write about it as some kind of achievement, like, look what I was able to accomplish. She writes about it only in terms of grace, only in terms of rescue. And is her life somehow more worthy of grace than the friends that she's lost along the way who didn't stop drinking and died of advanced liver disease or succumbed to something else? And the answer is absolutely not. And Paul in Romans goes on to say at the end of chapter 8 that there's nothing in life or in death that can separate us from the love of God. Even those who die tragically young, they're not outside the scope of God's love and grace. No one is. And in those moments when we have trouble holding on to hope, we can always do our best to imagine a further horizon, to imagine and believe that God is not finished with the world yet, not finished with us, and that grace really is the dominant power. I began with examples from film, and so I'll share a couple of images for hope that have always been helpful to me. One is Morgan Freeman's character, Red, at the end of Shawshank Redemption. Someone who had a life term in prison, served more than 30, 40 years, was finally released as an old man. He decides to break parole and go to Mexico to find his friend. And he says that he's so excited that he can barely sit still or hold a thought. He says, "I feel the excitement of a free man at the start of a long and uncertain journey. I hope to make it across the border. I hope to see my friend and shake his hand. I hope the Pacific Ocean is as blue as it is in my dreams." And then he ends with just two words, "I hope." And one more, because I couldn't decide which quote to end with. In No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film, which very closely follows the Cormac McCarthy novel. And if you're a fan of Cormac McCarthy, you know that there's a sense in which evil seems to have the upper hand. The novels don't always have a very optimistic outlook. But at the very end of No Country for Old Men, the sheriff, Bell, talks about a dream. He says he had two dreams about his father. In the first one, it seems like he lost some money somehow and wasn't quite sure. But in the second dream, he said it was like he and his father were both back in older times, and I was on horseback going through the mountains of a night, going through this pass in the mountains. It was cold, and there was snow on the ground. And he rode past me and kept on going, never said nothing going by. He just rode on past. And he had his blanket wrapped around him and his head down, and when he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire and a horn, the way people used to do. And I could see the horn from the light inside of it, about the color of the moon. And in the dream, I knew that he was going on ahead and he was fixing to make a fire somewhere out there in all that dark and all that cold. And I knew that whenever I got there, he would be there. Whatever it is that helps you expand your horizon, whatever it is that helps you hold on to hope, remember that and share it with others, especially when they may be having a hard time holding on to hope at that moment. And like I said at the beginning, the real ending of the sermon is going to be up to you and not to me. So we have two prayer stations. This one is kind of a meditation on Isaiah 43, the names that we imagine ourselves being called by God. Which means that it must be a life-giving name, because God is not going to call you a life-destroying or a life-crushing name, but a life-giving name. And so this prayer station is an invitation to meditate on that and to include that name in a prayer. And then the interactive prayer station 2 is on the baptism image. If there are patterns or things that we would like to die to or try to overcome, we can write that down on a piece of paper, tear it up, and then bury it in the soil. And then write down something new on another piece of paper, something that's giving you a new lease on life, something that's enabling you to have hope, and then you can take that paper or pieces of paper with you.